There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Business Breakfast, the bite-sized version thereof. This is our daily podcast that brings together the best bit of today's show, Wednesday, November the 6th. Two-thirds of UAE business leaders say that they've denied an employee a promotion in the past 3 years because their technical skills aren't up to it. We'll find out if our expectations for workplace advancements are out of whack.
Nearly half of respondents said they blocked promotions because of lack of technical skills. A lot as well, lack of leadership potential. Others said that they were seeing lack of experience in front of the people who presumably felt that they should be promoted.
Look, I mean, leadership and soft skills are much harder to measure, but tech skills are hard. You can see what skills somebody's got and you know what they're qualified to do. So, and it's also probably one of the hardest areas to achieve. So you absolutely need somebody with the right tech skills to go up the ladder. For the softer skills, somebody can bluff it quite easily, I think. It's much easier.
I disagree with that. I feel like you can sniff out people who've got real leadership sort of skills and people who don't. The problem is, I think a lot of people who don't necessarily have them in the golf market as a whole have traditionally climbed the tree regardless because of tenure. And that's one of the things that we were discussing this morning with Alex Coomey, the managing director of Kingston Stanley. You know, whether or not, because we were looking at the survey and thinking, hang on, all these people who their managers think aren't qualified to be promoted seem to think they should be promoted. You know, are our expectations, as Richard said earlier, out of whack? Are we in a stage where people think, well, I've done 3 years, you have to promote me?
It's time serving, isn't it? Yeah. So specifically, we said to Alex, is competency an issue when it comes to promoting people? This is what he told us.
Not everyone is right for a promotion. It takes time, it takes experience, it takes training, it takes development, and some of that is on the employer as well to train and develop their staff. Make no mistake, an employer would rather promote someone from within if they have the skill sets, because it's one, it's a better option for them. They don't need to bring someone from overseas. They don't need to train someone up from overseas. They've got an employee there ready.
And what's the usual cycle, we said, for workplace promotion? And actually, his answer surprised me. It was longer between promotions than I'd have thought.
It depends on the industry. I think if you're in an agency, an ad agency, a PR agency, you can progress somewhat quicker simply because there's more job titles. If you're on the client side, there's not as many job titles, so you can't progress as quickly in terms of the job title on your CV. But if to give you an answer, 3 to 5 years, I would suggest in for most jobs as a promotion.
Maybe we should start agitating here on the show. Remember how many years we've been doing this? 15 years now?
I
not
joined
a sniff of a promotion.
May 2015, I joined. So I've got about 4 months to go and then I'm going to be chief cook and bottle washer, who knows what.
I have been promoted. Did you not know I am the leader of the Business Breakfast, officially
on
paper?
Is that on your title?
Yeah.
Yeah, on your card?
Yes, you're my staff.
Oberleutnant Generalissimo.
Where it did get controversial was when we got into a discussion with Alex about whether or not you should ever take a promotion without a pay rise. This is what he said.
Absolutely. That can happen. Yes. It's more about the job you're doing and the work that you're doing. Money isn't a top five motivator for moving now. It's about enjoying your job, enjoying the work that you're doing, having fun at work as such, yeah, and progressing.
Now, a lot of people got in touch with us, feelings on both sides of the desk on this one.
Look, I mean, I think that if you're looking at, you're moving up a rung, theoretically, either in title or grade or something else, should you need more salary? Because I guess that the bottom end of one rung is going to be very much equivalent to the top end of the rung below. So I don't think necessarily you have to have a salary. Once you're in that better grade, then you can go upwards.
Look, Philip's been in touch with us. He says, I'm an HR director, and I always advise to benchmark the salary of a new role with the external market and the internal framework salary bands type thing. He says, if an employee is below that, then a salary increase should be awarded, possibly a step increase. But he says it's unreasonable for an employer to expect an employee to step up into a larger role with more responsibility without some form of financial recognition.
Anne has been in touch. She called us with her take on why we should take a promotion, even without a raise.
If it is a true promotion and not just a title change But it's a promotion that comes with increased responsibilities. I think you should take it. There is always a reason why a company is not able to fulfill the monetary increase at any given point in time, but they want to be able to progress an individual's career. When you do take it, I believe, this is my personal opinion, that you're in a better position to negotiate faster and quicker and a better increase when it is then feasible for the company.
Thanks, Anne.
I think it's fair enough, actually. I think that you want to go on the upper grade. You don't necessarily have to worry about salary so much.
Oh, I'm so in disagreement. I think if someone expects you to take on more responsibility and they think highly enough of you that they are giving you a promotion, then that should come with financial rewards.
If you are at the top end on the pay grade, if you're at the top end of one band, moving across sideways into the next, then you can go up further, but you're not going to go any further in your current brand. You need to be promoted for that.
Anthony's been in touch. Well said, Brandy. Malcolm and Richard are talking nonsense. Thanks for that, Anthony.
If somebody wants a promotion.
We could pretty much apply that to any section.
Should we use that breakfast? One of our sweepers and you play it every day?
He goes on to say, it is sinister to take on more responsibility. So it's a big no to promotion without a pay rise or a pay review within X amount of time. Thanks very much,
Anthony. I would disagree strongly with that. I think you need to go upwards and onwards, however you can do that. Doesn't necessarily mean that each salary grade is different, because if you go into a new role, you're not going to know less about the new role than you did about your old role when you were comfortable and at the top of the pay grade. I think it's doable.
Well, Nazar agrees with me and you. He doesn't go as far as to say...
Hey, Brandy's rubbish.
Brandy's talking nonsense, but Nazar says a promotion is a job description change. One's compensation, however, depends upon one's perceived value to the company. In today's cost-cut world, the two are usually not connected on day one. Now, money often follows, says Nazar, but it's almost never here on day one.
I just think you're sending a signal to your company about what you're willing to put up with. And I think it's dangerous.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Gulf Airlines are flying passengers around, making a loss of $5 a passenger. And this is coming out of IATA. They're calling on governments and industry to focus on low-cost infrastructure. Alexandre de Juniac, the DG of IATA, speaking at the 52nd meeting of the Arab Air Carriers in Kuwait, saying that the industry needs to reduce its costs. And to help us with that, we have in the studio Paul Griffiths, CEO of Dubai Airports. Reducing your costs for an airline, okay, you can, you can cut back some of your infrastructure, but as from an airport standpoint, how do you do that? Can you do it?
Well, I think the IATA DG is making a very generalised point about airport infrastructure globally, but we don't like being treated as a normal airport in the world, because we've got a very different structure here. There's a lot we can do, and in fact do, to keep our airport charges very low. For example, it's up to one-third cheaper to land here at DXB compared to some of our competitor hubs across the region and across the world. So we actually actively subsidise our aeronautical charges by using commercial sources for revenue like restaurants, bars, advertising, etc.
How much of that is, well, down to lower landing charges and cheaper fuel, though?
Nothing to do with cheaper fuel. That's at the market price. But the lower landing fees, the lower parking charges, all of those are deliberately subsidised by commercial revenue. So we make sure commercial revenue is the lion's share of our revenue income, so we can keep our charges to our airlines. That's been a deliberate policy at the airport ever since it started in 1960, and we plan to continue that way.
Maybe I should have asked you first of all, really. I mean, do you buy into that number, a $5 loss per passenger made by airlines?
I don't think it's due to infrastructure costs, due to other structural reasons within the industry, and I think global trade has something to do with it. So calling for low-cost airport infrastructure, I don't think is going to solve the problem, quite honestly.
It's really bums on seats, is it, the number of people that the airlines are flying at the moment?
I think, he goes on to say that, global trade is soft, and obviously that's having an impact on passenger numbers, but we certainly don't think that the way we operate and charge for our airport infrastructure is a major contributory factor.
So we're sitting here, it is November already, just a few weeks to go until the end of the year. What kind of performance are we looking at, would you say, for 2019 for Dubai airports?
Well, underlying growth is still positive, and that's a very good thing, particularly when trading conditions globally are quite hard. But I think the thing is, we've had a number of events this year. We had the closure of one of our runways for a month to undergo refurbishment. We had the bankruptcy of Jet Airways, which caused a bit of a hiatus of growth in the summer. And of course, we've had the grounding of the 737 MAX, which has had an impact. So where we'll end up, it will be interesting to see. It depends really on the strength of the production of the passenger numbers over the next few weeks to the end of the year.
Do you think that if let's say we get one-ish or two-ish, low single-digit growth or something around that. We've been used to 6, 7, 8, 9% growth for the 20 years I've been here. Is this just a kind of a blip? Will we then return in a year or two's time to 5, 6, 7% growth annually through DXB in particular?
Well, there's an absolute link between global GDP and passenger growth globally. And I think the global GDP at the moment is somewhat soft, and that will be mirrored in growth. So, but I do think that we've got very good reasons to be positive here in Dubai. We operate still the largest intercontinental hub. We're planning to keep it that way. And our investments in customer service and technology, I think, will put us in a great competitive position to attract more people to come to Dubai and more people to use DXB as the largest transfer hub in the world.
We've been watching recently Qantas with its long-haul flights, Perth to London, New York to Sydney, and these planes that can fly virtually anywhere in the world in one hop. Is this a threat to Dubai or perhaps even an opportunity?
Well, not at all, because if you remember, we've been here before when the 747-400 took to the skies and the Middle East, which had been a traditional refueling stop, they were overflying the Middle East. And of course, we didn't really see much impact on traffic. And this region has matured enormously since that time and has created both a vibrant O&D market, origin and destination market, as well as being a major hub. So the combination of those two things, I think, means that the future is extremely bright.
For Dubai, but I guess there'll be other airports around the world that are not going to get that benefit and will be overflown, if you like.
I think so. But remember, the thing about ultra long haul services, you have to take all of your fuel with them. So they're more expensive to operate than services through an interconnecting hub. And I think one of the most important things is there are hardly any routes that operate from DXB on which we have a predominance of origin and destination traffic. They're all supported by the transfer traffic that comes through DXB. That's why we have such a vibrant range of cities globally that you can serve using profitable services from DXB.
I don't know if it's your World Cup, but you've got the air show coming up in a few weeks' time as well. What are your expectations there?
Well, we think we're going to have a record show. We've already got 1,300 exhibitors. We're expecting 87,000 trade visitors, which is about another 8,000 more than we had at the last air show in 2017. The content, I'm sure, will be interesting. I'm expecting there'll be some announcements from the industry. So, and of course, that will all be set, hopefully, with the magical blue skies of the November Dubai winter. So it's going to be a good show, I'm sure.
Well, thank you very much, Nadeef, for coming in to join us. Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airports. We do appreciate your time and input, as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Business Breakfast Nightcap.
The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Mohammed Suleiman's with us in the studio with a copy of the New Zealand Herald.
Yes, so we are looking at an election today and a story that I think will make our resident Kiwi, Brandy Scott, very, very happy. So New Zealanders only have a couple of days left to vote in a very important election, but they're not choosing politicians. They're having their say to determine which bird will be named New Zealand's Bird of the Year. Brandy, have you heard of this?
It's huge.
It's massive.
We talk about this every year. We cover it live sometimes.
Really?
It's a big thing.
Just like the Melbourne Cup yesterday. Live results from the Bird of the Year. So this was first held in 2005, and since then it has grown exponentially. 48,000 people voted online last year. That's nearly double the number of people who elected the mayor of Wellington. So more people like to vote for the birds than the politicians. Now, with any election, the bird of the year has its fair share of controversy. After all, it is often described as the country's most important election, second only to the country's actual election. So a story from The Guardian this morning says that what started as an innocuous good fun has evolved into a national obsession, complete with voter fraud, skullduggery, and high passions.
People cheat.
People cheat, yes.
The thing that amazes me, there's only one bird that anyone else outside New Zealand's ever heard of, and that's a kiwi. I mean, what else is there, Brandy?
Oh, loads. We have hundreds and hundreds of native birds. And the serious thing behind Bird of the Year is that they take, I think the lineup's about 6 birds, maybe 8, 10 every year. And a celebrity or a politician gets behind each bird. And there is online campaigning, particularly through Twitter. It gets really, really heated. It gets very funny and it gets very clever.
You're not allowed to say, well, my bird's the biggest, therefore it'll serve more people on Sunday lunch.
No. But it gets huge. It gets really, really huge. And the people backing the birds take it very seriously. And people cheat. We have had Australians cheating.
Yes.
Pretending they're kiwis. We've seen that before, haven't we?
A couple of years ago, more than 300 dubious votes were received from an IP address in Sydney. So there is cheating going on from just on the other side as well.
Every year, there were a couple of Auckland teenagers as well one year that tried to hack it. Every year, someone tries to rig the vote. Last year, the Kereru won, which is the vote bird that I voted for.
Oh, you did. There we go.
So who are the candidates?
So there are about 60 candidates that can be found on the website right now, but the voting process is a little bit different from the previous years.
They've gone for party proportional representation.
Exactly, yeah. So every person...
Sorry, the bird with the most feathers, what?
People have to vote for their 5 top choices. Okay. Then there's a runoff, and birds eventually get eliminated until one bird gets chosen.
Is controversial in New Zealand because we don't have the first-past-the-post system when it comes to our national elections.
Ah, right.
We do have party proportional representation, which means that you end up with coalition governments, which people complain about all the time, but we're willing to do it for the birds.
We might have a coalition government. We can't have a coalition government if the top 3 birds win.
No. One will take it. And it can't be the Kereru again, which is quite frankly a shame because it is New Zealand's coolest bird. It's a fat bird that eats fermented fruit and then forgets that it's a fat bird and falls out of trees. It's brilliant.
So it doesn't sound like much of a bird. It sounds like it could be going the way of the dodo, frankly, falling out of trees. Not a good look. But what else is up there? Kiwi, I presume, will be up there?
No, it's always little known endangered birds that people need to hear more about.
Exactly. So the main point of this whole voting process is to raise awareness about New Zealand's native birds that are in crisis. So a recent report found that 2/3 of birds in New Zealand are threatened with extinction. So I'll just read off some of those names. There's the little penguin, there's the brown albatross, there's the Swellwind's mollywog, the Salvin's mollywog. So many different birds, about 60 of them. So about 60 of them on the website, but the defending champion is the Kereru. I've got a small clip from a bird expert explaining what makes the Kereru really, really special.
I just love Kereru. I love it in fruiting season where they're sitting on a tree, their crop's full, and then thinking about how am I going to fly. Kereru play a really critical role in our forest ecosystems. They're one of the only birds now that can eat the large berries of trees such as tawa. They're called the gardeners of the sky, and that's because they can eat these fruits and then they disperse the seeds throughout the forests.
Translated means?
They eat berries and then poop them everywhere.
But to be honest with you, any bird that can't hang on to a tree is doomed for failure, isn't it, really, if it keeps falling out of a tree?
Well, I think they're instantly going to become social media celebrities, right? Any bird that ends up doing that.
People do take video on their phones if they see Kereru falling out of a tree.
There you go.
They stick it up on Twitter.
Malcolm Taylor, save us from these ornithological oddities and tell me about a stock market listing in Saudi Arabia.
This is the Aramco listing in a 21-page document released by Aramco. The company called the IPO a unique investment proposition. The Aramco Chief Executive Amin Nasser says the company is committed to offering shareholders long-term value creation. A lot of Saudi individuals are believing that. But Norway's sovereign wealth fund, it's the largest in the world, they've said they're not going to invest in Aramco. They don't want to do it. They don't want to get involved. But the government is trying to press Saudi individuals and business families, and they're saying it's a patriotic duty. A patriotic duty to invest in Aramco. And we've seen pictures of people selling just about everything, the roof over their head. They're selling their houses, they're selling their cars, they're selling the other shares on the market, even though the Saudi market was up yesterday. Shares are being sold to create cash to put into the Aramco. Everybody sort of sees an opportunity to get rich quick here. It's a lot of pressure on the government, on Saudis, to create a bit of cash that you can put into the Aramco IPO. Because at the moment, it's only going to be listed in Tadawul. You can't make money from that share anywhere else in the world.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
We're talking the business of watches now, because Dubai Watch Week is just a couple of weeks away, and joining us in the studio is the Director General of Dubai Watch Week, Hind Abdulhameed Siddiqui. Hind, thanks for joining us. The big question we have ahead of this is the following. Can the likes of Rolex and Omega, the high-end luxury Swiss watches, fight the digital onslaught from the likes of Apple Watch and Fitbit, which has just been bought by Google?
I mean, for us, we always discuss this topic, and people who enjoy the luxury watches are not the same people who enjoy the digital watches. And actually, the digital watches have helped us, you know, see a new generation of buyers who, after using and or getting used to wearing a digital watch, today they are interested in exploring the luxury watch industry and they have the habit of wearing a watch on their wrist, so they're exploring the luxury watch brands as well. And today, it's very natural to see someone wearing two watches. You know, they have their digital watch because it can give them, you know, the number of steps, their heart rate and everything. And then on the other wrist, they're wearing the luxury watch, which they appreciate and have always wanted to own.
In some senses, we've been here before. In the 60s and 70s, the development of the quartz watch technology. Everyone thought, well, that would be it for the mechanical Swiss watch industry. No one needs these mechanical movements anymore. Mm-hmm. And yet over the past 20, 30 years, Swiss watches have reinvented themselves as luxury products, as almost collector's items.
Yes. I mean, we have your collectors, and we have your everyday watches that you can wear. The watch industry continues to evolve, and this year and during Dubai Watch Week, we're going to talk about innovation and technology in the watchmaking industry, not specifically in the digital aspects, but more in terms of technology and new material use and new inventions and movements in the watch industry. So it continues to evolve.
It seems to me that wearing two watches has got a limited future, really. And if these watches are truly luxury, do you foresee a time when those luxury watches will include things like Fitbit data and all of the other modern data that you can get from a watch? Do you see that sort of changing?
We've seen some watch brands like Tag Heuer, for example, starting to adapt into the digital watches as well. So they've included that. We might see luxury watches that can incorporate that. We have seen watch brands like FP Jewelry who started to put chips into their watches, you know, to help adjust the time, set the time. So there is this chance of technology moving into the watch industry.
Well, it seems to be working. Swiss watch sales were up 6.7% in 2018 over the previous year. A new research by Morgan Stanley, the investment bank, says it's being led by these guys. The so-called Magnificent Seven of the Swiss watch industry, the Billionaires Club, as it's also known. In reverse order, they are Audemars Piguet, Tissot, Patek Philippe, Longines, Cartier, Omega, and, of course, Rolex. Sales for the most high-end watches, says Morgan Stanley, is actually where the growth is. They're talking of watches more than 3,000 Swiss francs, which is, in ballpark terms, things 10,000 dirhams and upwards. I mean, your day job is Chief Marketing Officer for Siddiqui Holdings, which is a name synonymous with selling watches in this market. Is that where you're seeing the growth at the moment, the really high-end watches?
Yes, that's true. That's where we're seeing the growth. We have that's where most of the waiting lists are on these brands that you've just mentioned. So we have long, long waiting lists for these brands. Some are over 9 years of waiting list for you to grab a watch from one of these brands. So yes, they are dominating.
What about further down the pecking order? Watches that aren't status symbols or investment pieces, but watches that people buy because they need something to tell the time. How's that sector doing?
We still have people, especially in this region, who buy these watches as gifts. So we see a lot of people still investing in watches and they still find it a nice gift, you know, or a nice accessory to wear. There is a decline because of the digital watch aspect. And these brands are actually the brands that are looking into creating digital watches as well. So you'll see in their range of products that they have a digital watch.
How are those digital watches performing, though? Because I would guess that if someone was buying a watch for tech reasons, they'd go with someone who'd nailed the tech and the timekeeping was almost secondary rather than the other way around. Am I wrong or right?
No, you're right. So it depends on what you want your digital watch to do. So if you want your digital watch to be, you know, your health and fitness watch, then you're definitely going to choose a brand, you know, that is more strong in that aspect. And then you have the people who are confused. You know, they want a digital watch and they still want, you know, a good watch or a luxury watch. And they're the ones who would be more inclined to buy the watches you were just describing.
So some of the luxury Swiss watchmakers with these mechanical movements, Tag Heuer is one, Hublot is another, have made smart watches. Yeah. Is there much of a future in that? Is anyone actually buying those or are they just experiments?
See, with Tag Heuer, they did something very smart, because if you they tell you that when you buy the digital watch, you can bring it back and then exchange it for another real watch. It's really one where it's about habit. If you get used to wearing a watch and you see it as a luxury item and part of your accessory as well, then you get more attracted to buying the luxury watches. So it's not a bestseller for these brands, I must say, because they have fierce competition with the digital watches that are more popular.
How do you define the luxury watch category at the moment? What sort of price range are we talking about?
From the top,
What are the most expensive, and what would you where does luxury start?
It could start with Rolex. You can find watches that are 30,000 dirhams and that go up, and then you have Patek Philippe and Richard Mille that go up to 1 million, 2 million dirhams. So there's a wide range of luxury, and depends on the complications and the movements.
If you buy one of those, can you definitely make money on it? Will it always sell for profit or not?
Some of them, yes.
Well, a quick word on the second-hand watch market. We've got Kunal from the Luxury Closet on the phone in about 45 minutes' time. But typically, if I buy one of those high-end watches, let's say I walk into one of your stores or someone else's and spend 100,000 dirhams on a good Rolex or a good Patek Philippe, one of the Magnificent Seven brands, in 3 years' time, what's that watch going to be worth?
It depends on the model that you're purchasing. So if it's one of those models that everyone is fighting over and it's on the waiting list, then it could make a lot of money.
But something I could walk in and buy today, not on a waiting list.
I can't answer, because it really depends on the model of the watch and that you're buying, on the product itself.
Dubai Watch Week starts in a couple of weeks' time. It's great talking to you. Appreciate you joining us. Hind Siddiqui is the head of Dubai Watch Week. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.